Tonight I'm going to talk about the Brahma Viharas, also known as the Four Immeasurables, the Divine Abodes. There's a little story I like to pass on. The first time I heard of them was from a Zen teacher. There were this group of business people who approached the Buddha and said, "We really like your ideas, but it's just not in the cards for us to shave our heads, put on a robe, and travel around with nothing but a begging bowl. We've got businesses to run, etc., etc." So other than doing that, becoming monks, is there some way that we can achieve the heaven that you're talking about? And Buddha responded, "Yes. There are four states of mind. And if you can live in these mind states, then you will be living in heaven." And that accounts for their being called the Four Divine Abodes. And they are metta, or what used to be called unconditional love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And you probably know what compassion is, so I'll explain a little something about sympathetic joy. And that is when you get kind of a free ride on someone else's happiness. You know, they're happy and that makes you happy. It just multiplies. There's no subtraction. And equanimity is probably one of the least understood, or I should say, most misunderstood concepts in Buddhism. It's where some people get the idea that Buddhists are indifferent. They're turning away from life. They just don't care that much about what's going on outside of themselves. Well, that's not at all what equanimity is. In fact, if you were to go as deeply into the practice and the cultivation of equanimity as anyone possibly could, or let me put it this way, as deeply as you possibly could, you would find that you're also filled with love and compassion and sympathetic joy. All of the divine abodes have this characteristic. Each of them contain at least the seeds of all of the others. It's very common as we practice with the Brahma Viharas to get kind of fond of one of them more than the others. And this is perfectly okay. And so is switching around. You know, you practice metta wholeheartedly for 6 months to a few years, and then you find yourself attracted to sympathetic joy or equanimity or compassion. Spiritual growth, it just doesn't follow a straight line. It will jump around just the way we do from topic to topic or involvement to involvement. But while we're doing this, it's good to remember that the divine abodes are all aspects of an overall state of the enlightened mind and heart. This state of mind in the Mahayana tradition, which is Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, is called bodhicitta, or the enlightened heart and mind, or also the desire to realize enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And you may know that at the end of every session that I lead, I end with the dedication of the merit of our practice to the benefit of all beings. So these four states, as we work with them, eventually grow together into this enlightened heart and mind, or bodhicitta. What I'm going to be talking about this evening is the way that each of the divine abodes keep the others on track. So I'll start out with metta and talk about how it protects and guides compassion, equanimity, and I'm not going to talk about what it does for sympathetic joy, because I think that link is pretty obvious, that when we love another being and we see that being happy, it's going to make us happy. So in a way, metta is the prerequisite, or certainly a primary cause for sympathetic joy. So what metta does for compassion primarily is to guard it against partiality. And what I'm talking about here is the way that we make exceptions for the situations in which we're going to give ourselves to the mind state of compassion. For example, maybe it's just certain kinds of people or certain kinds of suffering that we let ourselves feel compassion toward. Maybe we don't want to feel compassion toward people who fit our criteria as evil, like violent criminals, or adamant racists, or whatever category of people we don't approve of, like political opponents, you know, people on the other side of the red-blue divide, or individuals that we personally dislike. Actually, we could find ourselves kind of rejoicing in their troubles. We can also make an exception for suffering that's caused by the individual themselves. You know, this is the old expression, well, I told you so. If you'd have just listened to me, you wouldn't be in this pickle now. One thing I've been running into for the last couple of years with my sister being very ill from emphysema is when I impart that information to a lot of people, within a second, I get the question, did she smoke? And I'm just now learning how to deal with that, to kind of turn it into the question of, why do you suppose that's important to so many people? That this suffering was self-caused. In fact, the very definition of dukkha is that it's self-caused. The cause of dukkha, according to the Second Noble Truth, is clinging. Only we can cling for ourselves. Nobody can cling for us. So it is self-caused. And when metta comes into the picture and opens the heart unconditionally to all beings, it doesn't matter. In fact, it kind of endears us to someone who's stepping on their own toes. And also, I get this a lot from people who are new to the practice, that they're very sympathetic for situations that are external. The kinds of things that the newspaper will talk about people suffering through, like an earthquake or a terrorist attack or conditions on the outside, but withhold compassion for suffering that's just internal. People who are just sad or who are jealous or, you know, all of the many ways that our clinging torments us. And the odd thing about this external causes of real suffering is that we don't all think of the same things as bad fortune. And I have a favorite story of the farmer whose horse ran away, but it goes on for some time, and I don't have that much time today, so ask me sometime. But the refrain in the story is, maybe that's too bad, but maybe not. So metta also imparts some very important help to equanimity, which is, again, the capacity to stay balanced in the whirlwind of life. I mean, just think of the emotions that we go through in a day, one day, and the many times that we have to keep coming back to a sense of being centered. That's equanimity. When we get back to a feeling of being balanced. So metta gives equanimity a quality of selflessness. We're not taking things personally when it comes to equanimity. We're not believing that my view of reality is any more important than others' well-being. Our concern, our love for all beings opens our mind so that we can take in all that is, not just what we happen to consider important at the moment. And during this campaign season, I'm really practicing with this. Metta also brings to equanimity the boundlessness of its nature, because like metta, it applies to all beings, phenomena, and experience. And it also brings a quality of fervor to equanimity. And it seems odd because, you know, equanimity is this kind of bloodless state we sometimes think, but it isn't, because it does contain this quality of love. It gives it warmth and joy. So compassion also is the protector of the other divine abodes. Compassion is personified by the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin. You may have heard of her. She who always sees the suffering of the world. And in the statues, very often, she is pouring the vial of compassion on all of those who suffer. Compassion reminds both metta and sympathetic joy that there is, in fact, more suffering in the world than they can mitigate. It keeps them from being superficial, because they can be a little frivolous. It's the old la-di-da frame of mind that compassion holds, I don't want to say in check, but in its embrace, that everything isn't fine for all beings. And it's wonderful to celebrate what is good, but also to keep the heart open for that other area of our existence. Compassion guards equanimity from, as I mentioned before, falling into cold indifference. And this is the near enemy of equanimity, the reason why so many people misunderstand it. People who try to practice equanimity often do that. Compassion urges equanimity to enter into the battle that is this world over and over again. It keeps us engaged. Equanimity is able to see the whole situation and will plunge into it to alleviate the suffering of whoever can be helped. Sympathetic joy, the giggler of the group, will keep compassion from becoming overwhelmed by the suffering of the world. It's said to be the divine smile on the face of the enlightened one, a smile that persists in spite of his deep knowledge of the world's suffering. It keeps compassion from becoming maudlin and dreary. It's really helpful if you are in a situation of supporting someone or a group of people who are suffering. You know, for example, when I was a hospice volunteer, to be sensitive, notice, and really savor the moments when they were happy and celebrate it with them. When equanimity and metta get together, some things that I wouldn't have expected happen. Equanimity will guard metta from going astray in the labyrinth of emotion that we have in our lives, because it holds that big picture in mind. It keeps us from rash action, just zealously going off and engaging in something and perhaps making excessive commitments. Taking the word metta literally as love, equanimity will remind us that we're not necessarily in love with individuals or with groups or causes. That we're inspired, we're enthusiastic, but it helps us pace ourselves in our involvement. Equanimity will bring to compassion an evenness and an unwavering courage. It enables compassion to face all of the world's misery and despair. And it's indispensable for those who want to practice service, the difficult art of helping others. Now, it's often said that equanimity is the crown and culmination of the other three Brahma Viharas. I once was a guest teacher for someone who apparently the previous week had said that equanimity was the equivalent of nirvana. I was asked that question by one of the group's members, and I said, no, it isn't. And I've never been asked back. Nirvana is the burning out of all of the things that cause us to cling, and therefore we don't suffer anymore. So it's different than equanimity. It may feel a lot the same, but what it is, how it came into being, is quite different. And there are other Buddhists, the Mahayana and the Tibetan traditions, that feel that it's compassion that's the crown of the Brahma Viharas. And what I would recommend is to consider them all one. Like the way that all phenomena are interconnected, so are the Brahma Viharas. In my mind's eye, I see a diamond, the kind that you see where all of the angles are the same and nothing sticks out more than anything else, and yet they all contribute to the form of all of the others. Every angle is part of the other angles. That's how I see the four divine abodes. But I will quote a writer who shows this when he claims that the crown of the Brahma Viharas is equanimity. He said, "Metta, compassion, and sympathetic joy continue to emanate from the truly equanimous mind and to act upon the world. But being guarded by equanimity, they cling nowhere and return unweakened and unsullied." Thank you.